The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Burlington Northern Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
Music does not happen in a place. In it, leaves do not grow, even if you try to put them there. There is nothing to see, and nobody knows you, even if you were born there. Yet the blood continues to follow music. The heart never sleeps, urging the feet of the blood to echo, to rest nowhere, to pass near the skin, to listen, whether music is anywhere, to look through a glass, to go on, to go through. Music never waits, the heart says. The blood says nothing. The deaf queen pacing alone through the thin palace, feeling music turning in the walls.
A poem by W.S. Merwin, where words and music meet. I'm Paul Anthony. And in this edition of The Nature of Music, the topic is words. Since the dawn of humankind, we've used both language and music to communicate. What is the difference between words and music? Can word alone be music? And how do words and music combine in song? A zoologist says that the way we use pitch in everyday speech is similar to how your dog uses pitch to greet the mailman. A New York jingle writer says nothing beats the powerful combination of words and music. And an anthropologist explains why we need to talk about music at all. So in this program, we'll be asking questions about words as music, words in music, and words about music.
I think some words can be music, because when we speak, of course, we're also using tones.
Anthropologist Tony Seeger.
My voice rises and falls as I talk, and we also use time. There's an internal rhythm to our speech. And so certain kinds of speech are really quite musical. If you listen to often public addresses by political figures, will have a very long cadence and very distinctive kinds of melodic patterns to them, as well as very clear rhythmic patterns.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Powerful, moving oratory. Great orators like Martin Luther King use words in a way that sound almost like music. If you listen closely to any spoken word, even to what I'm saying now, you'll hear a melodic contour and rhythm that's not far from music.
Your place or mine?
Sounds mighty good to me.
My mama told me never to trust a stranger.
Well, my mama said that she always relied on the kindness of strangers.
¶¶
if saxophones could talk, huh? Maybe they can. So you can listen to any conversation as though it were music. But which came first back at the beginning of human history, words or music? Anthropologist David McAllister has an opinion.
Music may have come long before speech. And speech is only an offshoot of music.
Why should music have come first?
To communicate feeling, because it's a much more immediate set of symbols than the linguistic symbols. That they're almost universal symbols, like loudness and harshness, that are associated with music. And they communicate without the interposition of words at all, just direct.
Perhaps music and speech have a common ancestor. Eugene Morton is a zoologist who says that both humans and animals use pitch to express basic emotions.
An aggressive animal, although it may be no larger or smaller than another, if it gives a low pitch sound, it's symbolizing, in essence, large body size and an aggressive motivation. It will tend to be a threat.
The same animal, says Morton, will use a high-pitched sound to make itself seem small, to appear harmless and submissive. Now, a dog could be barking at a person coming up the walk. This kind of bark only shows a general interest in the person. It's neither high nor low in pitch.
Now, if the human was its owner or its master, the barks would change to tail wags and whines as the owner comes up.
Morton says that humans use the same kind of pitch signals to indicate their moods. If you want to give a command or sound menacing, you do what animals do. You lower the pitch.
Go ahead. Make my day.
The words heard round the world. Now, if you want to sound small and harmless and submissive, you raise the pitch, like Scarlett O'Hara and her bows.
You handsome old thing, you. Oh, no, you're not. I don't mean to say that. I'm mad at you.
What have we done, honey?
You haven't been near me all day, and I wore this old dress just because I thought you liked it. I was counting on eating barbecue with you, too.
Well, you are, Scarlett. Oh, you are, honey.
It seems that Scarlett O'Hara and Dirty Harry have retained that primal means of expression based on pitch that zoologist Gene Morton talked about. There's other evidence for a common origin of language in music, too. Dane Harwood is a linguist who specializes in music perception and cognition. According to Harwood, the basic materials of language, that is, vowels and consonants, are similar to the basic materials of music, tone, color, and attack. Take the characteristics of a particular vowel, like ah.
Those change with a particular vowel like eh or o. And that's also true for the steady state component of timbre. It's what makes a trumpet different from a trombone.
So, how we distinguish between vowels is similar to how we perceive the timbre of different musical instruments. But the similarities don't stop there. When we pronounce a consonant like P or B, we're doing the same thing musicians do when they attack a note on their instrument.
One of the things we notice right away is the onset of the sound. A guitar is plucked or strummed, and that turns out to be a very fast, sharp onset. A violin is set into motion by a bow, and that tends to be slower. And our ear picks up those transient noises and codes them in a way that helps us, in a conscious sense, note the difference in timbre between instruments of an orchestra. And it's exactly the same way we would note the differences between different kinds of consonants.
There is a continuum from music to language.
Neuropsychologist Howard Gardner.
There's some things that one would call purely musical, like pure tones. There's some things that one would call purely linguistic, like syntax or phonology. But there's a gray area in between. And nature doesn't brook any complete discontinuities, and you can produce sounds which really are on the border of language and music. And in fact, there's even neuropsychological evidence to suggest that you can take the same sound, and if you present it in a linguistic context, it will be heard as language, let's say a vowel. But if you present it in a musical context, it will be heard as music. And that's a sign that the nervous system itself can introduce a bias in the interpretation of a signal, which will determine, so to speak, whether it's treated as a left hemisphere language kind of information or right hemisphere musical kind of information.
Composer John Cage.
And if you don't understand a language and hear a poem in it, I think your tendency would be to listen to it as though it were music. In other words, music is something which we don't understand, but we experience. If we understand it, we're not so certain that it's music. We think it might be poetry.
Two for Marion, two for Telusk, two for Telemet, nad te shunkleels, two for Siad, nad hiskint, I have no shiedef, sith tumkos, for tsvor rofoyu, nuisteting tittle fortitatamite, esseth era royal losums, royal urte canfisigants, hotug thiner for suquentineth. Thiner for suquen wo te sulping larity, for iam elov dol noe ayad mecobe a ronconai, for Rembrandt remek, a save rof royo dafid mobile, a raxed raj for urigo, a bombt shooped up two of Marion, two of Taylor.
According to John Cage, if you don't understand a poem, it must be music. This poem gradually undergoes a metamorphosis. If it begins as music, it ends as a poem.
And the conch shell out of days and nights. I have nociative this costume of words for you, nuisteting little of it at a time. These are your symbols, your true canfisigants, though neither of us knew it then, neither of us knew how the pulsing reality of my love would one day become a ronconai of Rembrandt Remek, a vase for your faded bloom, a cracked jar of rouge, a tomb, pushed up out of memory, out of the skull, out of the helmet and the conch shell, out of days and nights. I have fashioned this costume of words for you, untwisting little of it at a time. These are your symbols, your true significance, though neither of us knew it then, neither of us knew how the pulsing reality of my love would one day become a container of remembrance, a vase for your faded bloom, a cracked jar of rouge, a tomb.
The poem Dedicace, written and recited by Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer. We've been talking mostly about the similarities between words and music. Historian, critic, and humanist Jacques Barzin has a definition of the difference between the two. When you listen to words, he says,
It gives you a sense of definiteness, which you can reproduce immediately. You can repeat the words, or you can explain their bearing, or you can translate them into another language. When you listen to music, the impression is just as definite, but it cannot be articulated. It remains in the realm of intuition. That is why certain people have said that you cannot talk about music, which is nonsense. You can talk about anything. And other people have said that music is a pure art, and it has nothing to do with life, and that again is nonsense. It is simply a different medium, just as paint is a different medium from marble, or dancing is a different medium from poetry.
Earlier, Howard Gardner said, "Nature brooks no discontinuities." In My Fair Lady, Rex Harrison plays with that continuity between words and music. He talks, he orates, he half sings, and once in a while he actually slips into song for a few notes.
Look at her, a prisoner of the gutters, condemned by every syllable she utters. By right, she should be taken out and hung for the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue.
Meow.
I ask you, sir, what sort of word is that? It's ew and gone that keep her in her place, not her wretched clothes and dirty face. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be selling flowers too.
I beg your pardon, sir.
An Englishman's way of speaking absolutely classifies him. The moment he talks, he makes some other Englishman despise him. One common language I'm afraid we'll never get. Oh, why can't the English... why can't the English learn to speak?
Song is one of the most evocative things in the world because of those two very strong elements, the element of poetry and the element of music. And when they're together right, I don't think there's anything that can make you more excited except maybe for a wonderful woman, and sometimes even not that.
And you'll take the sky.
Billie Holiday, one of the most influential singers of all time. On this edition of The Nature of Music, we're talking about three ways that words and music relate to each other. The first part of this program was about how you can think of words alone as a kind of music, words as music. Later in this program, we'll ask the question, how can words describe music? And in this part of the program, we're dealing with how you combine the two, words in music. Jake Holmes composes jingles for top New York ad agencies. We asked him to choose one of his favorites.
Well, the Army one, Be All That You Can Be.
And explain how he created just the right music for it.
They wanted something that was masculine and strong and at the same time had an emotional quality to it.
There's a hungry kind of feeling, and every day it grows. You know there's so much more to you than anybody knows.
I think what happened to me was I came up with the beginning. There was a hungry kind of feeling deep inside, it grows, and something like that. And it was like I could feel like there was a sort of a building. There was a sort of a feeling of desperation almost. I felt like some young kid who was looking for his, you know, for the answer to life. And then when I got that sense of it, then that tension and tension, and then it was easy to build to the release. You know, Be All That You Can Be seemed to come naturally for me.
Inside you, feelings, there's so much more. There are no words that can explain the things you're looking for. You're somebody special, so much you're gonna do. So you're gonna reach out and take it, 'cause it's all there waiting for you.
Commercial jingle by Jake Holmes, who tries to write music that brings out the feelings in the words without overpowering them. There's a special class of powerful words which anthropologists call vocables. We all remember as kids the vocable eeny, meeny, miny, moe. But I didn't know it was a vocable, although it wasn't a children's song. Magical incantations and chant use vocables too. The words don't have any obvious meaning, and that's exactly why they're powerful, according to anthropologist David McAllister.
By chanting, you persuade people in ways that you couldn't do with ordinary speech. Navajo chanting is an example, where if you say, Shinchi deya heye, shinchi deya heye, shinchi deya heye, neyo, instead of saying, Shinchi deya, That means the same thing. It is starting out towards me. But you've extended it, added melody to it, added a specific rhythm to it, and introduced vocables that don't mean anything and give it an air of mystery. They sing that phrase over and over and over again until you're wondering and you're ready to go out of your mind, wondering what it is. And then finally they tell you it's a magical horse from the top of a sacred mountain. And then they begin telling you more and more about it. And by that time you're in such a mood of receptivity that you can't help yourself. And you're persuaded that that horse is going to come to you. So by the time you're through with this chant, all your troubles have gone away, and wealth is coming your way, and happiness is coming your way, and it's done. It's just the usual way, in fact, an almost universal way among human beings of accomplishing magic.
If the words are more powerful than the music in chant, the opposite is true when words are set to Western classical music, according to composer Leo Kraft.
There's a music in poetry which the poet has put there, and the composer comes along and overrides that music and adds another of his own, even if the composer thinks that he's simply heightening the music which the poet put in. But it rarely works out that way. Goethe preferred the settings of his poetry by Zelter to those of Schubert. Goethe was very sensitive to musical values. I think he somehow realized that Zelter was not overriding the what was in the poem the way that Schubert was. Schubert just made everything go his way.
That's Schubert, of course, not Zelter, with a setting of Goethe's poem Der Erlkönig, or The Earl King. On the nature of music this time, the subject is words and music. We've considered words as a kind of music in themselves, and words in music as in song. Now we deal with words about music. How can words possibly describe music? Isn't music self-contained? Anthropologist Stephen Feld.
You know, if music is so self-contained, why do we spend so much time talking about it? Well, maybe the reason is that we talk about music in order to be social, in order to indicate, you know, the fact that we have some of the same feelings about music.
According to Feld, some people think that talking about music means using terms like minor third, major third, fourth, and fifth. Even these are metaphors, he says, just like the word scale, which refers to a ladder. Feld found some insight into this problem during his research with the Kowloon people in Papua New Guinea.
Linguistic metaphors are very important for us in terms of understanding some of the ways that people think about music. And when I went to the Kowloon and tried to talk to them about song, at first I didn't understand what was going on because everybody was talking about water. And I thought that this was just a matter of my linguistic incompetence and, you know, that I couldn't figure out what was going on. So that I would compose a song and they would say to me things like, well, the waterfall ledge is too long before the water drops. Or I would sing and they'd say, that's a lot of splashing. I mean, some of the times when they're talking about water, when they say there's a lot of splashing, for instance, you know, what they were telling me was that the rhythm and meter in my songs were completely choppy and messy.
For the Kowloon, says Feld, water is a powerful image. Societies in general latch onto images that are powerful because they transcend many kinds of experience. For Black Americans, the word soul embodies more than a musical experience.
So soul has to do with food, it has to do with clothes, it has to do with the way you walk, it has to do with music, it has to do with style. And water has to do with, you know, the way you live, with what's around you, with what you hear all the time, with the way things naturally sound. And it's the same sort of thing. I mean, water is to the Kaluli like soul is to black music.
Shorthand words like soul and waterfall may be okay for describing our thoughts in everyday speech. But when you write about music as a professional in our society, jazz critic Martin Williams says you'd better be specific.
There are critics of music and all the arts, indeed, who do what I think of as a kind of impressionism. That is to say, they're primary business, as they see it, is to tell you what the feeling is in a piece of music, or how you should feel if you read Walt Whitman, or how you should feel if you listen to Verdi or Billie Holiday, or look at Picasso. That has always struck me as a kind of limited view of how to discuss the arts, because I really don't want someone to tell me what it feels like to read Homer. That's something between me and Homer, it seems to me. The best piece of criticism I ever read in jazz, one of the best, is an essay that Andre Hodea wrote about Art Tatum. I think it is absolutely wrong in every respect as the way to look at Art Tatum, to evaluate Art Tatum, to listen to Art Tatum. But if you read it and you play some Tatum, then you know how you feel about Tatum. And that makes it a good piece of criticism because it forces you to come to your own conclusions. And that, I think, is what criticism is about.
William says there's another basic approach to writing criticism.
What is this work, this performance or whatever, trying to do? And that doesn't mean the composer's intention, what he was trying for. That means what do you get from the work itself? And the second question is, how well does it do that? What it seems to be after? How well does it execute that? And the third question, and notice this is the third question and not the first, is it worth doing? And a lot of people put that question first and never get to the substance.
If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series or information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on music and words, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Don't forget to mention the call letters of the station you are listening to and the title of this program, Music and Words. Our program on Music and Words is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. Richard Reary is the mix engineer. Michael Wilpers is the research assistant. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Paul Anthony. This is NPR, National Public Radio.